Crib Notes, things parents Google at 3 a.m.
Welcome back to Crib Notes. It's Rick and Sarah here, and today we're talking about nutrition.
This is something we've had lots of questions from new parents about: breastfeeding, formula feeding, how to optimise their child's nutrition, and things like tongue tie and weaning. We thought we'd speak to one of the leading professors in the country, Professor Mary Futrell, who also works for the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health, and she's a paediatrician by background.
And one thing we really want to look at as well is, how are kids able to grow and develop healthy bones and brains? How
so
on
important.
Earth can they do it? Anyway, just a quick note from us as well. Thank you so much for sticking with us. It's great to hear so many positive comments and media reviews. We'll try not to let you down.
Don't forget, what's discussed today is the opinions of the individuals and not the organisations they work for.
And while we hope you find this podcast helpful, remember, this is not personal medical advice. If you are concerned, do speak to a professional.
Thanks for inviting me.
No problem. I love it when people say that. It's like, well, it's great to have you on. So, first of all, let's just start off with infant feeding. Why is it that what your child eats is so important? Because it might sound like a really basic question, but it's not, is it?
Obviously, an infant isn't going to grow and develop normally if it doesn't have proper nutrition. And the requirements for nutrients for babies in the first months, first couple of years of life, is much higher than at later stages. And also all the organ systems and the brain particularly are developing during that time. So if they don't get proper nutrition during that time, it can have some effects later on.
One of the things parents want to know about is this particular early period of a child's life. Is it more important than other time periods?
We do have data that suggests that how babies are fed in the first months of life, not only the type of feeding, but also how their growth pattern can influence, for example, their risk of becoming overweight later on, or also metabolic diseases such as type 2 diabetes, perhaps their risk of heart disease, and also perhaps their brain development. It's a lot more difficult in humans to get this sort of information. As you can imagine, it would mean that you had to study infants and then follow them up for years if you wanted to really see what happened in the long term. So,
and benefits of breastfeeding specifically, can we talk a bit more about that?
Yes. So I mean, I suppose the starting point is that we are mammals, and like all mammals, we are designed to feed our babies. So that should be the first food for a baby, ideally. And in terms of the sort of health effects of breastfeeding, the most important one is the reducing the risk of infection in the short term. So particularly tummy upsets, also chest infections, respiratory infections, and actually reducing the risk of needing to go to hospital with an infection. So that is reduced if a baby is breastfed, and the more exclusively they're breastfed, the greater the protection. Mm. And the protection really seems to last mostly while the baby's getting the milk.
Yeah.
Whether that's because the alternative to breast milk might be sort of contaminated, or whether it's that you lack the sort of protective
antibodies
and things in the milk, who knows, it may be a combination.
Is it because breast milk basically just has everything? Mm. That's why we don't need anything else for the first few months?
Yeah, I mean, breast milk basically it has evolved to provide the nutrition that the baby needs in the first months of life. So most healthy term babies with healthy mums should get all the nutrients they need from breast milk for around 6 months or so. So nutritionally, they probably don't need anything else. But actually, I think it's also important to say that when breast milk first evolved, going back, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, actually the anti-infective properties were probably the first thing. Nutrition was probably a secondary thing. So it's not really surprising that it has these very good effects at protecting the baby against infection. That's how it was designed.
I think it's particularly interesting that people say that it's probably the best tailored pre or probiotic that your baby can actually have in terms of their microbiome. People are now, you know, buying these expensive things online later down the line.
What does that mean?
So you must have seen in health shops, people buy probiotics. It's a big fad thing.
Right, yeah.
And it basically is something which they say is going to feed the gut bugs. But actually, that's what your breast milk does.
Yes, exactly. I mean, breast milk produces probably the ideal microbiome for an infant. And as well as providing the nutrients and all of the other anti-infection components. And of course, breast milk contains lots of things that we don't fully understand. I mean, it's even got stem cells in as well, which probably get into the baby's organs from the mother. There's lots of ways in which breast milk, in a way, the mother can send signals to the baby, and we don't fully understand them all, but it could never be replaced in an infant formula. You can replace the nutritional components in an infant formula, but actually a lot of these other non-nutritional parts of breast milk that we don't fully understand can't be put into a bottle.
A pre-packaged formula. Yeah.
What about the mum's health as well as the baby's health? Because there's a lot of talk about how it can reduce breast cancer as well.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most established benefit of breastfeeding. I mean, there are... it may possibly also protect against ovarian cancer as well, but the breast cancer is probably the most evidence-based.
And bone health as well.
Yeah, in some ways, I think the evidence is less secure for that. One of the problems in trying to sort of work out what the benefits of breastfeeding is that if you think about it, you can't do a trial, like a randomised trial, randomise mums to breastfeed or not. So you're always looking at groups of mums who've decided to breastfeed or not to breastfeed. And of course, they differ in lots of other ways. There are other factors that can explain why they might have different outcomes. Mm. So it's always difficult to be really sure.
One thing Sarah told me beforehand was there was evidence that can make you smarter. How does that work?
Limited
evidence.
That's one of the more controversial things. Does breastfeeding make your baby brainier? And actually, it's related to this problem that I just talked about, because what you tend to find, at least in societies like in the UK at the moment, that the mums who choose to breastfeed and breastfeed for longer often come from more affluent backgrounds or may have better education themselves, the mothers.
Right.
And therefore, it's quite difficult to prove whether it's the breastfeeding that might make children smarter, or whether it's what we call confounding. But I mean, even when you do studies and you try to take into account those factors, there probably may be some small beneficial effect of breastfeeding. That's probably not the main reason for doing it. The main reason for doing it is,
And I guess there's also the benefits of things like bonding between mother and baby.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're very important, although it should be said that if the mother is really stressed out and, you know, unfortunately, not all mums get all the support they need to help them breastfeed, and if they're having problems and it's not going well, then equally...
It's much more important having a happy,
it's more important to have a happy, healthy mother and a happy baby. So, in an ideal world, if it all works well and the mum's well supported, then yes, it can be great for bonding. But I don't think there's any evidence that babies who are bottle fed are any sort of less secure and happy if they're treated in a
good to know.
Good way,
and our current guidelines in the UK are for exclusive breastfeeding until 6 months. And that was recently renewed in the recent guidelines. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So the Scientific Advisory Committee on Nutrition did a review and concluded that the recommendation should stay the same, that babies should be exclusively breastfed for around the first 6 months of life. I think the around is important because, as with all of these things, as with sort of a baby crawling or walking, you really don't expect every single baby to do everything on the exact same day of life. So there has to be some flexibility. I mean, I said earlier that actually in terms of nutrition, for most healthy mums and healthy term babies, breast milk will have enough nutrients for 6 months. So probably in terms of extra nutrition, the baby doesn't really need a lot more. But I think the sort of whole idea of the complementary feeding or weaning is it's not all about nutrition. There are lots of other things to do with weaning, like behaviour, culture, social aspects, and, you know, babies starting to take an interest in foods, maybe before they actually need extra nutrition. And also the possibility that, you know, you could be exposing babies to small amounts of perhaps allergenic foods or even different tastes and flavours. I mean, the evidence is not hugely convincing on that, but certainly that's a possibility. So I think it's important to recognise that if you talk about weaning or complementary feeding, you're not talking about suddenly just giving three meals a day alongside breastfeeding. It can be a gradual process, often with tiny little tastes of food initially.
Yeah, we just got the pack at home, you know, the pack, kind of the new parents pack that says you should be breastfeeding your child for 6 months. And it's really kind of it's very straight. It kind of makes you feel, if you're not going to breastfeed, that, oh, okay, then maybe this is something I should be doing, because there is a lot of people in my family who have not, you know, chosen to breastfeed. And when you got that pack, you're like, oh gosh, what am I doing wrong? But don't panic.
I think, you know, it is a risk that when you try and have, you have these recommendations which you think is going to be in the best interests of the baby's health. But you've got to be sort of careful about how, not making parents feel guilty and stigmatized if they can't or decide not to do it. I mean, obviously they need to have access to the information.
Yeah.
They also really need to have good support. And I think, you know, with breastfeeding, one of the big problems in this country is that we don't necessarily have enough practical support for mums, particularly if they come from families where perhaps their rest of other family members and friends haven't breastfed, and they've not really seen babies being breastfed, and they have no one to help them. They need good quality support.
I think that's so important. Yeah. It's getting help early as well, isn't it? Because the evidence is, if it's in early, can make a real difference. One of the things that lots of parents talk about is tongue tie.
So, well, tongue tie, I mean, I think the first thing to say is it's not a sort of black and white thing. You don't either have it or you don't have it. It's a sort of almost like a continuum, because it refers to basically how far the baby can stick its tongue out and how joined the tongue is to the bottom of the mouth. And, you know, in the most severe cases where the baby does appear to have the tongue quite well tethered and it can't really stick its tongue out very well, in some cases that can cause problems with breastfeeding. So, and it can also lead to the mum having sore nipples and what have you. So I think the treatment for it has become having a sort of surgical procedure, like basically snipping the extra piece of skin so that the tongue is freer to move, which can be done completely safely by the appropriate people.
Local anaesthetic, usually in babies.
Yeah. So it's a fairly sort of simple procedure, but the question is, does it need to be done? So if you actually look at the evidence, there's not a lot of research been done on it. I think there was a review a couple of years ago that included data from about only 300 babies, so it wasn't really very convincing. What it did suggest was that if a baby had the tongue tie divided, it might reduce the mum's nipple pain, but there wasn't really very convincing evidence that it improved the ability to breastfeed. And so I think what the general advice is that if you think your baby has a tongue tie and you're having some difficulties breastfeeding, the really important thing is to get help with the breastfeeding first and to have someone who really knows what they're doing assess you and try to get the baby to latch on. And if all else fails, then maybe consider having the tongue tie divided. But we certainly don't have really good evidence to tell us what is the best thing.
When I speak to mums, they do say that, who've had tongue ties, I'm talking about, they do say they feel upset that the tongue tie wasn't flagged up when the baby was born and went home from the postnatal ward. I think it's important that we discuss this and highlight to parents that actually tongue tie is a real spectrum.
Yes, indeed.
And, you know, there's lots of babies who might have a very severe tongue tie but no issues with feeding, and they do not actually need surgery. Definitely. And it will not go on to affect their speech or language. But there's others who may have minor tongue ties who actually may need more support. And so it doesn't mean that it was forgotten or missed at the
Indeed, it's just not a black and white thing that you either have tongue tie or you don't. It's a sort of whole continuum. Actually, there is a scoring system, I think, now for tongue tie to try and grade the sort of different degrees.
Is it that common?
It's meant to be. I think the review of the literature concluded it might be present in up to 11% of babies to some degree. But of course, that could be a very mild degree.
And it again depends
on how you define it.
Wow.
It's just the little attachment there between the base of your mouth.
This is where we need a picture.
Yeah. So I'm actually, so we could all have it.
Yeah.
We could all have it.
Well, John's got it. My husband has it, but actually has never had any problems with feeding or talking.
He talks far too much.
So actually that just shows you really don't need a tongue tie operating on unless it's necessary.
No, I think that's right. You should first try and sort out any feeding issues by sort of normal means. And then if that fails, then maybe consider the procedure.
I think that's really important information for mums. But I also want us to talk a bit further about formula feeding, because there are many mums who they've tried breastfeeding and it didn't work out for them and their baby. And they want to know what the right thing to do is formula feeding.
Yeah. So, of course, we have to recognise that not all mums decide to breastfeed, or more commonly, actually, mums mix breastfeeding and formula feeding. I would say, actually, if you do want to breastfeed, it's important at the beginning to establish breastfeeding, because if you start giving the baby formula, it won't be very hungry, and then you might find it more difficult to actually establish breastfeeding. So it's best to do that first.
Because of the supply and demand.
Because of the supply and demand process. So that's an important point. But obviously, if mums decide that they don't want to breastfeed, or they want to mix the two, there are a lot of choices out there, as is apparent if you visit a supermarket.
Yeah.
I think the important thing to say is that the composition of infant formulas is controlled by law. So there's a European directive which controls what are the things that have to be in an infant formula and the minimum and maximum levels. So
things like salt, then.
Salt, protein, carbohydrate, fats. So all of the sort of essential nutrients, the vitamins and things, they have to be in all formulas at a certain level. And there's usually an upper level as well, so that the baby can't get too much of anything. So any formula that you buy, any infant formula that is marketed for babies under 6 months of age will be strictly controlled. The places where formulas differ are in these sort of almost optional extra ingredients, where the European directive doesn't say they have to be in the formula.
Right.
And that's generally, that could be things, for example,
like a dessert?
Probiotics or something. Well, there are certain things like that have been proposed to potentially have beneficial effects for the baby. The evidence for these sort of modifications is variable. It's better for some things than for others. They're certainly not harmful, or they wouldn't be allowed to be there at all, but whether they are positively beneficial, the evidence is just not as secure as for, you know, some of the major nutrients and things. So
and
that's
overall,
why you get
a lot
variation.
Of it's branding as well, isn't it? It's
yes,
trying to say that it's a different product to the one next to it, but actually they're pretty similar inside.
Yes, I mean they have to be similar in all of the essential things, because that's controlled by law. And then the additional things, they are allowed to put them in. And of course, there are a lot of restrictions on what the companies can say about the benefits or otherwise of these things. That's all quite strictly controlled.
I had to giggle there. I was looking at one of the brands earlier today, and they have pictures on and implying that, you know, this particular formula is going to make their child a mathematical genius, or you know, have the balance of a ballerina. So actually, they can't.
But that's an important point. They can't do that, particularly on the infant formula. So the breast milk substitutes that are below for use below 6 months, so like the first stage formulas, they can't have anything that idealises the formula, So. That's more strictly controlled. What's not so strictly controlled, and I think can be confusing for parents, is the follow-on formulas and the young child formulas or growing up milks, which
and they're the ones that are advertised for 6 months and
six
over.
Follow-on formulas are advertised from 6 months. So the ones where you're talking about seeing like ballerinas or mathematicians, and I think you sometimes see adverts on the television, that's allowed for those products.
We're trying to avoid advertising in hospitals now, aren't we?
Yes.
Because we also know that isn't particularly helpful, because it's associating a specific brand with having a specific benefit. And actually, that's not something that we support as the NHS
I mean, I certainly don't think paediatricians or healthcare professionals should be endorsing or being seen to endorse particular brands, because any infant formula that you get off the shelf in the UK will be suitable for use in a baby.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's for healthcare professionals to be, you know, advising mothers to use one or the other. The only reason that you would have to do that was if there was some sort of good research that sort of proved that something had a particular benefit. But if that were the case, then you would expect the European directive to start being changed so that it would be put in everything, in all formulas.
When it comes to frequency and formulas compared to frequency with breastfeeding, is there any natural difference? Because obviously it's a lot easier with breastfeeding just to, you know, to put the baby on the breast. But when it comes to formulas, you've got to make it up, you've got to have it all prepared. And when it comes to nutrition, is that something we need to be thinking about, frequency?
I think probably the biggest concern with formula feeding, bottle feeding, is it's easy to overfeed. because as you say, you've got to make it up. So you make up your certain amount in a bottle. You know, there's obviously guidance on the tin about approximately how much the baby should be having. And I think there is evidence that the tendency is just, it's just human nature. You try and encourage the baby to finish the bottle. Whereas, of course, if the baby's breastfeeding, it's much more in control of what it's taking.
And the
in
flow
fact,
of the
you don't
heat
even
as well.
You don't even know what the baby's taking when you're breastfeeding. So, you know, in a way that what can worry mothers, but actually that's the way it's supposed to be. Whereas with bottle feeding, I think the tendency is you've made up this amount and you want the baby not to waste it and to try and encourage it to feed, to take the whole bottle.
There's more energy expenditure in breastfeeding as well.
Yes. Yes, probably on average you would expend more if you're breastfeeding than bottle feeding. But I think that one of the big things at the moment is to encourage the so-called responsive feeding, so that parents understand that, you know, just because a baby cries doesn't mean it has to be immediately fed. There could be other reasons for it crying, which you should think about. And that applies to breastfed babies, not just formula. But also that you should try and understand when your baby's hungry and when it's full, so that if you're bottle feeding, you're not necessarily expecting that it's going to finish every bottle. So you need to try and become in tune with your baby, if you like, rather than think it's got to have a certain number of ounces of milk.
I think culturally we want to feed up babies, don't we? We have this belief that we need to fatten them up, but that's not really the case, is it?
No, I mean, I think that probably comes from, you know, history, where I guess being a sort of big, bonny, chubby baby meant that the baby was quite healthy and likely to survive, whereas if you were sickly, you're probably more likely to die. But it's probably a bit of a hangover from that we like to see. It's funny, really, because we have this idea that we like seeing chubby babies, whereas if we saw a chubby older child, we would probably think that was not good. So, there is quite good evidence now that actually one of the things that predisposes to overweight and obesity later on is this pattern of growth growing sort of faster, which is again why you don't want to be overfeeding babies.
Mary, thank you so much for coming on. I know we're going to have you back though to talk about complementary feeding, so see you then.
Crib Notes, things parents Google at 3 a.m.
Don't forget, what's discussed today is the opinions of the individuals and not the organisations they work for.
And while we hope you find this podcast helpful, remember, this is not personal medical advice. If you are concerned, do speak to a professional.